open the Senate Revenue Committee. Good morning. We survived another week, and this is going to be our last week, I think, at 9 a.m., looking at our schedule. We'll bump it back to 8:30 starting next week. Today we have three bills from the Department of Treasury. Senate Bill 21, Senate Bill 22, and Senate Bill 24. So why don't we take them right in order. Paul, are you the Mazin? Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 21. And Mazin, I thought you had all the fun departments. You had like the lottery and beer and wine, and somehow you got the treasury in there also.
You know, Mr. Chair, good morning. Yes, I have the gambling and the money too.
It's true.
So, Senate Bill 21. This basically allows or deletes a prohibition on the investment of certain funds in international or foreign-owned stock, if you will. And it's of two sections. The first section talks about some state-controlled funds and your SMS. And in the background section, you would find the different funds that were included in that prohibition. There's quite a number of them. And the second section of the bill also opens that restriction, if it's related to the local government investment pool. Those, of course, in the international or the foreign-owned stock is seen as the more unpredictable or riskier stock to in the past to look at or to own, and that's probably something that is more understood these days and less thought of that way as risky. And that's what I think what is behind the bill in that sense.
Thank you. Mike Mueller from the Oregon State Treasury and Ron Schmitz also from the Treasury. Please. Your suits match.
It was planned that way.
Almost.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, for the record, my name is Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division of Oregon State Treasury.
And I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments at the Treasury.
With respect to Senate Bill 21, as mentioned, the pooled fund is looking for a removal of the language restricting the holding of securities originating outside the U.S. I shouldn't emphasize these are for money market type securities, short-term debt instruments, not equities. We seek the removal of this constraint to improve the yield and gain better diversification within the portfolio. Some who might hear the request to allow foreign securities into the fund will assume that this means higher risk. It does not. The short-term fund would not incur foreign currency risk, as the investments we're envisioning would be dollar-denominated investments. Nor would the securities purchased be shaky credits. These are highly rated agency credits as rated by U.S.-based rating agencies such as Standard & Poor's and Moody's. As example of a couple of the names that would be available to us if this language was changed, Royal Bank of Scotland, a high credit quality bank based in Edinburgh. It would be a foreign firm that would issue U.S. debt. That could be available to the short-term fund portfolio manager to invest in. Another more common example would be British Petroleum, which has a U.S.-based subsidiary called BT America, which owns a Midwestern-oriented refiner and distributor of gasoline called Amoco, and also a West Coast-oriented ARCO. And again, these would be dollar-denominated debt instruments. So in conclusion, we think this request is well within the bounds of prudent investing. It's beneficial to Oregon. And I thank you for your time. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. So the natural question, I guess the natural first, too, is what is the short-term fund?
The short-term fund is I guess technically there are two pools of assets, but they're really managed together. For Treasury purposes, we refer to it as one pool, but it's a money market fund in essence. It's short-term instruments, at least 50% of which has to be under 90 days, and then no more than 25% longer than 3 years with a maximum of 3 year security. So it's a very short-term focused fund.
And Chair Deckard and members of the committee, it holds the cash assets, if you will, of all state agencies, and local governments participate as they choose to do so. It's approximately, I believe, $8 to $9 billion currently.
And do you know, and we just have to get your name for our records, the rationale for the prohibition in the first place?
Chair Deckard, I do not. It's probably not an uncommon prohibition. It dates back years when foreign investing of any kind, equity or debt instruments, was viewed as extremely risky. And in fact, that's probably part of the reason that there's a little bit of a yield advantage. A similar credit that's a foreign company, even though it's a U.S. dollar-denominated credit, will often yield a little higher than a similar credit in the U.S. just because it's international and there's a little bit of a perception of higher risk there. But it's not an uncommon prohibition, or wasn't years ago, and most states have generally removed it.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, Senator Starr?
Is there perhaps some degree of economic stimulus involved in investing funds in a company, as it might impact that company's ability to grow?
Chair Deckard, Senator Starr, I guess to a degree that would be true. If all investors walked away from a given credit or a given company, they wouldn't have working capital resources to operate.
Chair Deckard, that seems to me to be one of the issues as regards investing in American stocks and bonds and so forth, as opposed to foreign investing. As we're more of a global market, it seems like that there's less reason to retain that kind of investing policy. So I guess I'm ready to see us move ahead.
Thank you. Other questions or comments, Senator George?
Let's see, a headline that says Oregon intends to take taxpayers' money, $8 to $9 billion, and invest it out of the country. If I could, I'd require you guys to invest it all in Oregon, because this is where the economy is hurting. And I just think it looks really bad that we're taking dollars that were generated from the taxpayers of Oregon and sending it possibly offshore for investment in another country. I don't know what that does for Oregon. Can you help me out on that?
Sure, Senator George. Chair Deckard, I understand your concern. First, I would clarify that this would never be all of the short-term fund going outside. There is a governing board, the short-term fund board. They would have to approve parameters ultimately once the language, if the language goes through as requested. They would have to approve language. For prudent diversification purposes, it would be a percentage of the short-term fund that might be available for such investments. But prudent investing requires that you invest broadly and diversify your portfolio, and in all Oregon type fund, for example, just wouldn't meet the prudent investor standard, which is also part of the statute that we operate under.
Please.
When you take the total investment portfolio, not only short term but all of this stuff that's invested for PERS and all of the other one, and I suppose we're probably what, around $45 billion or something like that?
Close to sixty billion.
Okay, what percentage of that is invested in Oregon in things that might encourage the economy of Oregon?
Senator George, it's hard to, I guess I didn't anticipate that kind of a question. I don't have a hard percentage for you. I could certainly get back to you on that. But there is, the Treasurer's Annual Report does put out investments that are in, that are Oregon companies, or if not Oregon-based, at least companies that are very active in Oregon. I believe the number is 400-some million. Several hundred million, anyway.
Several hundred million out of up to $60 billion.
Yes.
That percentage would be like 0.00 something, I'm sure.
It would be small.
Be a very small percentage. Okay,
thank you. And perhaps you could use this as an opportunity. We did pass, and I don't know where we're at with the legislation that was passed last session, directing $100 million of the OIC to, and I know we've retained Credit Suisse to start administering that. Do you have comment in terms of where that direction is, or if they've found some firms to start investing in?
Sure, Chair Jack. That portfolio is underway. There's been an advisory board formed of local Oregon people that is working with to advise Credit Suisse First Boston. An RFP was sent out. I think 185 firms downloaded or got copies of that RFP. About 26 responded. CSFB and the advisory board are in the process of winnowing that down. CSFB will make a final decision within the next couple of months on the initial investments of that $100 million from HB 3613.
Mm-hmm. It's Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. I had forgotten that. And that is, one of the rumors is that one of the first units that might invest that money in Oregon was a Beaverton-based company. But we understand that the rumor is that those dollars have been transferred back to New York. Is there any? Do we know anything about that? Is that correct, or is that just one of those rumors of the Capitol?
I hope the puzzled look on my face suggests I don't know what that is.
Okay. I'll see if I can find that. I meant to do that earlier. Thanks.
We can probably chase that down this morning with someone from the Treasury. That would be news to me. If
I knew you would care. That's why I was asking the question.
Anything further? Any other questions?
Senator Deckard. Again, for the record, it's Mike Mueller. I'm the Assistant Director of Investments for the Treasury. If I could just follow on Senator George's question regarding investments overseas. The goal in all we do is to achieve the highest return prudently possible, and I think that benefits all Oregonians, be it overseas or otherwise. Recognize that the short-term fund invests in highly secured debt instruments only, and to find such investments in the state of Oregon, municipal bonds might be one you might think of, but the yield on those, obviously being tax advantaged, would not benefit the performance of the fund and thereby Oregonians as I would see it. So I would just add that to the record.
Do you know, Mr. Mueller, do we have other restrictions on foreign securities in statute? I wasn't aware of this one, but my guess would be, in reading, I think it was Warren Buffett and now Bill Gates have both started pulling out of the dollar, which is at least a sign that they're putting more faith in foreign currency and foreign investment. I would just be curious if we have other restrictions that we've placed on the Treasury in terms of prohibitions on ownership of foreign securities.
Chair Becker, there aren't, to my knowledge, statutory restrictions outside of this one, but certainly there are governing boards for each of the pools of assets that we manage, and those governing boards have policies and procedures, and those guidelines do put restrictions on. For example, OPIRC has a 20% target for international.
Other? Senator Metzger's deep in a statute. This could be dangerous.
I got it figured out.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 21. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 22 and greetings. Mr. Malik.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 22 is in somewhat similar position as we were talking. This one removes prohibition of the state treasury investing certain funds in common stocks, and those funds are defined. That three. But let me first just mention that the investments in these funds are basically governed by the Oregon Investment Council, which is a five-member body, four of whom are appointed by the governor, and the fifth is the state treasurer, who also acts as the investment officer. The three funds, first of two of them would be for the PERS fund, or the public employees and its predecessor, and the industrial accident fund. Those had certain prohibitions on investment in common stock. It also, this bill provides the council the ability, the monies in the fund were previously to be in the deferred compensation fund, to be only invested in common stock through mutual funds. This allows two things, basically, for the treasurer to be able to be in the decision-making process and management of how the different funds would be invested and decided on, which in essence basically changes the nature of the management of these investments, and also allows a more relaxation of how those mutual funds versus the stocks are done accordingly. It, however, in that sense, I don't think there's a fiscal impact, as we saw as I asked the fiscal office, and the revenue impact on the state is no immediate revenue impact. No revenue impact on the state.
Thank you. Mr. Mueller, Mr.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you. You don't need the, for the record, my name is again, do you?
We do.
Could have, for the record, my name is Ron Smith, Director of the Investment Division of Oregon State Treasury, and with me is Mike Mueller, Assistant Director of the Investment Division. What Treasury is asking for today is the repeal of language in ORS 293.736 that prohibits direct ownership of equities. So to be clear, we're not looking for an expansion or additional equity exposure within the funds we manage, but the removal of the prohibition that keeps us from running internal portfolios. Right now, we have to go outside to hire external investment managers. Direct ownership of equities creates two significant advantages for the state. It's cost reduction through lower fees paid to these external managers, which in some cases is quite significant, and I'll elaborate on that in a minute. It also allows Treasury to leverage the existing relationships we have by reducing the number of managers that we need to employ, and making it more efficient to provide oversight to those funds that we manage. There are a variety of initiatives that can be undertaken if the prohibitive language of 293.736 is repealed. The first would be co-investment in the private equity and real estate arenas. A second would be common stock portfolios managed by Treasury staff. If I may take a second just to define co-investment and what I mean by that, using private equity as an example. If OPERF puts money into a partnership, a general partnership, that has a corporate finance strategy, for example, we would join other limited partners as being a legal partnership fund. We would pay the general partner certain fees and percentage of the profits that are made in that fund. What we would do if the language was lifted or repealed here is also go to those same general partners, let them know that we're interested in co-investing, which is making side-by-side investments with the fund, but outside of the fund structure. We'd be investing in the same companies the fund invests in, but it wouldn't be part of the fund structure and therefore would exclude the fees and share of profits that are paid to the general partner. excuse me, there's obvious advantage to OPERF here is in that it saves millions of dollars in fees, There's also, oddly enough, an advantage to the general partners, even though they give up some fee revenue if the fund were larger that they would earn. But they like to have, most general partners like to have a ready pool of limited partners that can do such investments, because when they come along, they get an investment that's too large for the fund, as an example, which is pretty common, they can go to the LPs in a friendly working relationship, if you will, with their limited partners, and do the investment, whereas without that capability, they would have to go outside and syndicate the investment and invite, in fact, their competitors in on the deal to share the investment with them. So there's a win-win here, even though the general partner gives up fee revenues. But the clear win for Oregon is reduced fees within the funds that we manage. Ultimately, there may well be an additional staff and some expenses that are related to such a program. But I think with a relatively small amount of assets that would be involved in co-investments, we could save literally $10 million in investment management fees that otherwise paid out external managers. In the public equity arena, it's not uncommon for other states to allow their investment staff to manage in-house portfolios. Strategies range from relatively low-cost passive investments in pure index funds to more active strategies. As you look at the more passive and simple strategies to implement, the fee savings is of course less because the outside manager cost is less. You might experience fee savings of a couple hundred thousand dollars, for example, in an index fund strategy, again, depending on how much assets you put into the strategy, whereas more actively managed programs could save, you know, $1-3 million, again, depending on size of the portfolio that's run internally. At this point, I would take a step back and indicate, let you know that implementation of such a program, even if the language is changed as we request, is not a done deal. You have to make sure, we would have to make sure, and the governing boards that we work with would have to make sure that the investments that we would do are competitive with the external manager. So you don't want to be penny wise, pound foolish, for example, and save fees but give up investment return by the strategy. So what we would envision, and what I've done in past organizations where I've worked, is you back test various strategies using historical databases that are available both to the investment community at large, the academic community. Back test strategies, try to, you know, find something that you think works, and then you would actually run a paper portfolio live, real time, going forward to make sure that going forward the strategy that you back tested works, so you don't you keep yourself being guilty of data mining. And then finally, if over a period of 6 months to a year, maybe even longer, if that strategy looks like it's working on a real-time basis, then you would go live with limited assets, get a toe in the water, and build up the portfolio over time. So I just wanted to kind of give you that process so you didn't get a sense that we would just be rushing out doing an experiment, as it were, with the monies that we're entrusted. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Can you think of an example? I mean, the example you provided, but a fund or one that you would do that test with and then move forward.
Something a little more concrete. For example, we might embark on a strategy where we try to replicate the broad market closely. But we would want to put a yield enhancement on. So we would maybe screen for companies that pay a little higher dividend than the market. So and try to enhance returns a little bit that way. So you can back test that strategy, run an actual live paper portfolio live going forward, make sure it works, it's doing what you want, it gives you the exposures that you anticipate, and then obviously run it live if all looks good. But that would be just one simple example. But there'd be a variety. I mean, almost anything you could think of, you could actually, you know, test and possibly run a live portfolio. But I think what we would envision is really something that's kind of a low-risk market exposure. It's kind of a strategy.
Rather
than something that's really out on the risk spectrum and taking, you know, taking more active bets.
Mm-hmm. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By deleting this prohibition, at least the way I read it, isn't it true, though, that potentially the state treasurer could manage all the investments? I mean, potentially, you're talking about limited use, but this basically would allow them to potentially to be the investment officer for all investments.
Senator Metzger, Chair Decker, that's true. We didn't I guess in drafting the language, we didn't put a cap on or some sort of prohibition on the amount that could be brought in. I think, again, from a prudent investor standpoint, it would be highly unlikely that that would ever be the case. We would always, right now, OPR, for example, has 80 relationships with external managers. And there, we just wouldn't, now a lot of that is equity and real estate, or bonds and real estate. It's not all equities, for example, but within the private equity and public equity arenas, there's still over 50 relationships. And there's just, I mean, it's just inconceivable to me that we'd ever get to the point where we would actually do as you suggest. But you're right, technically, I guess the language doesn't put a cap.
On that same note, I mean, right now we have the Oregon Investment Council, they hire managers. They're obviously picked and, I assume, sustained basically on their performance. And that's checked by the OIC, that's checked by the state treasurer. You know, they're the checkers of the checkers. Give me some confidence here that if in those situations or any other situations, which this, the state treasurer became that manager, who's checking the checker there? I mean, where is the checks and balance for the state treasurer becoming the manager of accounts when the treasurer is the one that usually makes sure that the investment officers are doing the job and he becomes that role? Who checks him or her?
Senator Metcalf-Chadwick, a great question, and one that I guess is an example of being too close to the forest to see the trees. To us, it's fairly clear, but I can understand why to you it wouldn't be. The Oregon Investment Council, for example, would still be the governing body I'm envisioning this being an OPERF initiative more so than the other funds that we operate. But the OIC would hire, in essence, hire Treasury staff under the same standards and criteria that they would an external manager. And it would still be, you know, the investment oversight still would go through analysis by an outside consultant and approval by the Investment Council, as well as ongoing monitoring by those same two bodies.
Here's my only concern. I understand what you're trying to get to, and I certainly aren't opposed to the objective of, you know, there may be situations in different funds. Certainly if I'm, you know, investing in a money market fund, you know, so that's kind of a no-brainer. I can, you know, pick a five-star, multi-star money market fund. I shouldn't be paying X amount of fees, and I can garner other returns. But by opening it up unlimited, I guess one of my real concerns would be always looking for the unexpected, not because of the expected, is if we put the state treasurer, which is a political job, you know, into that position. You know, I'd be concerned about, you know, having the potential for lobbying by various investments with the state treasurer, because he would have the authority to invest in different, without having a series of checks and balances. And the OIC, of course, is an appointed board, political board as well. But I could just foresee the potential of having a, you know, an elected position also be in the position to, you know, be influenced by different investment decisions without as many checks and balances. And I guess my preference would be, is there some way with this legislation there could be a more narrow application of it rather than just opening the whole thing up and all of a sudden have, you know, everybody, you know, wanting to have dinner with the state treasurer to have their investment because they now have an authority they didn't have before. I guess that's my real concern.
Senator Metzger, Chair Becker, I think there are probably some things that we could craft that would get at your concern a little bit. But again, to make sure that you know, we're kind of on the same page, any strategy that we would envision here would be a well-defined strategy. It would be pretty, I think, in most cases, pretty clear if there was an undue outside influence coming in and investments kind of all of a sudden did a right turn and went off in a different direction from the stated strategy. And again, in addition to full-time Treasury staff that aren't elected people and a little less, at least a little less subject to those kind of pressures, there are standards of ethics that the CFAs we have on staff have to adhere to that would be some protection against that. We do use, the council does use outside consultants and an outside custodian bank to actually house the securities and then the outside consultant to evaluate the investments that are being made in the portfolio that's being run. So there are layers, I think, of protection there. Clearly, I guess, in an extreme case, what you're suggesting could happen. On the other hand, as a practical matter, If you're running a portfolio with 200 securities, and if there aren't that many Oregon-based companies even to get your arm twisted to invest in.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily thinking Oregon makes
it. It wouldn't have to be. I mean, yeah. Oregon-based yeah. companies. To, Senator George and
yes, Senator George.
Following up with Senator Metzger's questioning is that in the past there's always been this arm's length appearance that there would not be those kind of interties. Let me ask this question. Does California, like, for example, their public employees' retirement plan, do they have this kind of control? Do they have the authority to, within that operations of its publicly run, in other words, the state investment, to decide where the money goes?
Senator George, Chair Jack, they indeed do. Both CalPERS and CalSTRS have internal investment operations. Many states do, particularly the larger states. When you get up to $50 billion plus, it just becomes a matter of good economics to consider that. Florida, for example, does internal investing through their staff. The state of Wisconsin does. Texas does. There's a wide variety of states that do. Generally, the larger states, the more populous states.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to tell a little story. In my district, a very, very large investment has been made in a wine production. It's plus $50 million. It came from an investment of California PERS. The interesting thing about that is very much to the detriment of the largest wine-producing state in the world. Okay, they made an investment in Oregon, which is going to help our wine industry, and I really appreciate that. But if I were in California and I was looking at this, I wouldn't be exactly happy about encouraging my competition. And yet that kind of thing has happened. The other thing is 55% of the state is already owned by the federal government. Now we're going to enter into the real estate industry if I recognize what I think the potential of this is. What impact do we think that'll have on the real estate market? I mean, am I going to be in direct competition with you, or am I going to be in direct competition with California PERS for a piece of property? Because that's what I see happening here. And how much of the state are we going to be happy to have government-owned?
Senator George, Chair Deckard, let me clarify a little bit with respect to the real estate portion of your question, at least. OPERF has an 8% target in real estate. This would not increase that target. All it would do is within the 8% change slightly the mix of right now it's all through external managers. This would allow some internal management. So it wouldn't increase the amount of money that we're putting into the type of investment. And I don't really think it would, you know, again, the co-investment is driven by external, in the co-investment example anyway, it's driven by the external general partners that are bringing a deal to us. So it's not us going out actively sourcing either Oregon or California properties. It's when something, for one reason or another, doesn't quite fit, usually because it's too large for the fund that's been raised by the general partner and they need more assets. That's where the co-investment opportunity comes from. So I don't think the kind of crowding out or bidding up that you're suggesting is something that we would envision at all here.
There is a trend that many people have spotted, and that is because of the massive holdings that are in public hands today, that you're seeing a political correctness emerge, that there's enough pressure on companies who have made investments, whether it's manufacturing or whether it's real estate, to be PC. We see right now the sustainability effort that has come forth in this state, in which I really see a potential for tremendous political correctness. In other words, your business is good and your business is bad. The potential would be there for this fund to be manipulated for political correctness. Is that correct?
Senator George, Chair Deckard, I think certainly not to the extent you fear it might be. I mean, right now, corporate governance, you're right, is very much a hot button. Some states, California, Connecticut, North Carolina, for some to mind, are extremely active in those areas. But they are actually doing it, whether it's an internal investment or an external investment. Can you do it through your stock ownership rights and your voting rights? So the whether we're running, directly owning equities through an internal portfolio or owning equities through an external portfolio would not matter in that regard.
Could I get a little clarification
on
that?
Please.
Thank you. So even though we have an arm's length holder of the equities, we can influence decisions that they might make relative to putting pressure on someone whose assets they have holdings in?
Senator Dreyfuss, we do through the proxy voting rights for the public securities we hold, yes.
So we retain those.
We retain the proxy voting rights, but the investment decisions are actually made, you're correct, by the arm's length third-party manager.
Thank you.
And perhaps it'd be helpful to back up to the... Are you always, and I think California Investment has the same, or CalPERS has the same statutory requirement, driving towards meeting our statutory requirement that you maximize the return for the investments that we have with almost blinders, other than when we do a bill like we did last session or we did the South African divestiture. Is that accurate, or do you feel in some way?
Chair Deckard, I think that's quite accurate. I'm not quite sure I'd say blinders, but yes, we're very much driven by prudent investor standards, which require that you do... You generate the best possible return you can for your beneficiaries. And as a technical matter, a lot of people like to think of OPR, for example, as the state's money, but it's really the beneficiary's money. And the second a check is written from state coffers or local government coffers and it goes into that trust fund, it is actually not the state's money anymore. It's the beneficiary's money. And our duty is to invest for their benefit, not for the state's benefit. So you're right. There are legal blinders, if you will, that require us to kind of keep our eyes on the straight and narrow, as it were.
Where does California have that similar statute that Oregon has that governs its investments?
I don't know for sure, Chair Deckard, but I believe they do. Mm-hmm. Most states have, ERISA is really was oriented in the ERISA rules, which go to administration as well as investment of retirement program assets. It's really directed toward corporate pension plans, but most states have, the government equivalent written into their statutes, and I'm certain California does, although I couldn't say it with 100% guarantee.
Mm-hmm. Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Chair. I want to follow up on, I guess, the first set of statements or questions that were asked from Senator Metzger and kind of come down the line here. It would seem maybe appropriate for us to see what other states actually do have this type of investment process available to the state for internal decision making, and I think that might make some of the members a little bit more comfortable to see how broad that actually is, and then maybe what checks and balances any of those models may have on how those investments may actually be carried out. And I think the chair's brought up a pretty good point that there are certain standards that are within investment philosophies that our investors or our employees are going to have to follow, no matter just as if it was being done by an external. And it may be worth giving us some type of primer on some of that stuff as to what's in place so everyone kind of understands. And I appreciate you putting on the record that, really what you are trying to do is maximize the benefit, and that's what your obligation, your fiduciary obligation is to those beneficiaries to actually get the best return, understanding that unless we do something different that mandates a certain type or style of investing, that's what you're charged to do.
Senator Starr, any thoughts or questions? If you could think about what safeguards we might be able to put in, you'd mentioned a cap, and I'm thinking of if that's the way to get at the checks, but if there's another way to design statutorily some sort of check there, it'd be interesting, I think, for this committee to consider. Senator Pozanski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's worth looking at, but I guess I'm going to be very cautious about putting a cap. That could be defeating the whole purpose. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that maybe there's something else that we can see, and maybe it would just tell us what from the other models from the other states. If they don't have them, then maybe we don't need them. Mm-hmm. If they do have them, let's see what they have, and I'd be surprised, except on a PC level, that we'd have caps, because it seems to me it goes contrary to maximizing those returns.
Yeah. And you hate to put them in statute. Some cap has been placed in the state statute.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
Dr. Senator Pozanski, we can, sir, I can, in fact, I can run you through a laundry list. I think I did a little bit earlier in the testimony. It's pretty easy to get, because I think we have some databases that tell us which states allow it. The checks and balances aspects of it might take a little bit more time, but I can certainly do some spot checking and see what I can come back to you with.
Senator Brzezinski and Senator George.
Just a real quick follow-up, and not statute, but it may actually, you may find something within their rules, administrative-wise, that would maybe have some type of more flexibility, but still establishing some control over it.
Senator George.
I guess informative to remember that we've had these prohibitions up to now, so if we did, in fact, put some sort of cap, that wouldn't be out of the ordinary. The other thing is to we could have an absolute comparison of what we could expect for any additional, because the word risk keeps coming up in the statements, in the written stuff, statements that we've had from you, but there is additional risk potential there. I would like to know over the long haul, particularly through the late 90s, how these other states that had those investments, how they fared versus a more conservative investment plan that we had. So if we could get some comparison there, I suspect they probably did worse.
Probably some did better, some did worse. I mean, I'm sure it's a distribution.
Chair Decker, if I could add again, Mike Mueller, Assistant Director of Investments at the Treasury. I don't see this as adding risk to the portfolio. I just see it as a different way to manage the same assets. I don't think that we're looking at increasing or decreasing risk, just reducing costs.
Anything further for Senate Bill 22? Thank you. Appreciate it, and I think we've got you for one more bill. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 22. Dr. Meyer. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 24.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 24 deals with the Common School Fund and the distributable income account within the Common School Fund. Currently, the statute lists different kinds of income that go there, profits, dividends, and interest. The bill proposes generalizing that to just income, no matter what kind of income it is, so that all income within after expenses and as much as the state land board deems appropriate then would be transferred into that distributable income account and from there to school districts. That's the first part. The second part is to delete the language that requires losses from investments in equity, from the sale of equity investments to be subtracted or deducted from the distributable income account.
Committee, with us today are Mr. Mike Mueller and Mr. Ron Schmitz from the Oregon State Treasury.
Senator Deckard, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments. In support of Senate Bill 24, a couple things to note. Modern portfolio theory subscribes to managing investments in what's called a total return basis, that is, not just giving consideration to the current income, but also the appreciation aspects of a portfolio. Managing a portfolio for income and or just to minimize losses may not be in the best interest of the fund beneficiaries, in this case K through 12 education. The current statute as written appears too prescriptive in its language and provides for investment terms that are not clearly defined and may be subject to interpretation. The proposed legislation will align the law with the best practices of money management from a prudent investor standpoint. Lastly, the distribution of the funds from the Common School Fund should not hinge on the year-to-year investment activity of the fund, i.e., how much income, gains, or losses were taken, but rather based on the long-term performance of the fund. So in summary, I think this bill would provide the land board the flexibility to smooth the distributions to the schools, and secondly, would provide the Treasury the tools to more effectively manage the assets of the fund on a total return basis. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Mueller? Wow. You know, we had many questions in the previous fails. Well, we cannot let Mr. Mueller off.
Three cents.
Paul, do you have any good questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Metzger.
Mr. Mueller, maybe you could give us an example of the situations resulting in losses from the distributable income account and how that and why that is negatively impact on the common school fund, either a real example or a hypothetical example of what we would be correcting.
Okay. Chair Decker, Senator Metzger, one example would be perhaps the repositioning of the equities within the portfolio. Depending on where we are in the investment cycle or at a point in time, if we wanted to transition those assets to a different investment, say, for example, we're currently passively invested and we wanted to invest in a different equity product or the investment council chose to do so, we'd have to liquidate a portion or perhaps all of the equity investments that we currently hold. And if they were underwater, we would sell those and realize a loss that would then flow to this distributable income account and would have to be made up in the future and would impact returns K through 12 in that current year, even though it may be in the best long-term interest of that fund to switch those investments, recognize those losses, and reinvest the proceeds going forward.
Okay. Senator George.
So you have something that's upside down and it's now declared a loss, and you're going to shift it out. Currently, you could do that anyway, correct?
Correct.
So the question is do you take the loss off of the amount going to common school fund? No? Okay, I'm washing heads out here. So if I'm assuming you have a loss, and where is this money going to come from to cover the loss, or is that a hypothetical number? Help me with that question.
Chair Deckard, are
we taking part of the investment portfolio to cover the loss, or is it not just something that occurred on books?
Yeah, Chair Deckard, Senator George, just think of this fund as you would your own personal assets if you were to reposition them. You wouldn't necessarily look at the portfolio at a point in time, say over the 1 year, what did you do? What we're getting at is to look at this fund in perpetuity for the long term. Yeah, you may have a difficult year and recognize some losses, but we know that in prior years and in the future years, hopefully, we will earn a return sufficient to cover those losses and meet the distributions that we're making in the current year. And all we're asking is that we not hamstring the portfolio such that we make investment decisions in the short term that may not be in the long-term financial interest of the fund.
There's been a great deal of debate. This is a little bit off, more general than what this bill does, and I know it's somewhat constitutional, but there's been a great deal of debate about the Common School Fund. Do you feel, and the management, what legislatively we can do and cannot do in terms of the management of the Common School Fund, do you have an opinion from the State Treasury in terms of, I guess, best financial practices? Are we using the Common School Fund just as a reserve policy and how it is set up today? Is it something that, and I know this is a dangerous question, that we should at least look at as a legislature in terms of the construction of the fund and the limits that have been placed upon it?
Chair Deckard, I think the fund, given the restrictions that are in place, has performed extremely well. This last December, the fund crossed over $900 million for the first time in its history. So the fund has done quite well, and the distributions, obviously, the schools benefit from those. I'm not as familiar with the constitutional restrictions on the fund, but I do believe that the proposed legislation here would certainly take us further along in terms of what we need to what we believe to prudently manage those investments more effectively.
Good answer. Other questions for the panel? Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 24. Committee, are we okay on 24? We can hold it.
If he wouldn't mind.
Okay. We'll be happy to hold it. Kate, can you come up and talk to us about just the previous question on the Credit Suisse, and I forget what we called that bill. And Mr. Schmitz will just... Yes, of course. I didn't know who we would have just...
Like Al Pacino, I tried to get away.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff for the Oregon State Treasury, and thanks for the heads up. Senator Decker, could you just give us a little more detail about what you're looking for as far as an update, just the status of it at this point in time, or?
And the question that was posed, and if you need a day or two to get back to us, I guess it was more that we had heard that some of our, I hadn't heard this, but it had been heard that some of the investments had not been made in Oregon firms, or that some of that capital had been displaced to New York, which would obviously defeat the intent of that legislation. If you need to look into it, you need to look into it.
No, sure. I think I just need it a little more clearly articulated, and I am going to have Ron speak to this, and we'd be glad to also come back to your committee and give a more comprehensive overview on the status of House Bill 3613 from last session as well. But to that, your specific point, I'll let Ron direct.
Sure. I think that there could be a couple of different things that the rumor might be referencing. First, the implementation of 3613 in part we're attempting to accomplish through the Credit Suisse relationship, and that is indeed a New York-based investment bank, a private equity firm, the largest private equity firm in the world. So we did not hire an Oregon company to do those Oregon investments, and I don't know if that's really the genesis of what you were referencing. I took your question earlier to be a specific investment. But what Credit Suisse is doing is they are not making individual company investments. Their charge is to invest in various venture capital and private equity partnerships. Those partnerships right now are envisioned to be both Oregon-based general partners as well as regional general partners, probably most likely Washington, but some California firms as well. And what they will do then is try to leverage those relationships, because we would be an investment within a larger fund, so that our investment would lever the fund and encourage that fund to make investments in Oregon. And that will, you know, so if we put $10 million in a fund and it's a $100 million fund, for example, you know, you can see the power of the leverage there. Now, not all $10 million that we place would necessarily, you know, not every investment by that general partner would go into Oregon, nor is it required to be. Again, that comes back to the prudence issue. But the first fund investments that Credit Suisse will make, I think the first announcement probably will have an Oregon-based general partner as well as a state of Washington-based general partner. The relationship between Credit Suisse and those general partners, there are side letters that require those general partners to look at Oregon investments. And they have to commit a certain amount of time, have an Oregon office, and there are certain provisions within those contractual relationships that bring those general partners to Oregon to look. But it doesn't mandate, or we're not forcing an investment in Oregon companies. It's just, again, the OIC's position on how to implement and reach the goals of 3613 deemed that would not be, you know, subject to the prudent investor standards, which 3613 recognizes in its directive.
Yeah, we put a clause in there to do just that, to say the $100 million, mm-hmm. but ensure that if it's not, that it's a prudent investment, and that we're not, I guess, taking those blinders too far off.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, this particular relationship with CSFB, or Credit Suisse for Boston, is a primary thrust of the implementation of House Bill 3613, but it's not the only way in which the Oregon Investment Council is implementing it. It's been one of the more public and obvious, and I would say, constitutes a great deal of the implementation, but it's not the sole way the Investment Council is moving forward with this bill.
And they've opened an office in Oregon, I believe, mm-hmm. to help manage this investment.
CSFB does have an office and a person full-time here in Portland.
And Kate, we need your name.
Again, my name is Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff at Oregon State Treasury. You're very good at that.
These guys keep me, every time I forget it. Thank you. Any questions on this, Senator George?
Mr. Chairman. I'm troubled by something, and you know, we're out all the time. It's the kind of the emphasis of my office is trying to figure out what do we do to get this economy jump started, because it is the economy, and I don't want to add the other word. But the thing about it is if we don't view, we the people of Oregon with our investment portfolio, don't believe it's prudent to put that money that I believed when we were voting on that thing wasn't in fact going to be directed for startups and investment in Oregon. If we don't believe that's prudent, we're in worse shape than I thought we were. I mean, that's more of a comment, but tell me about the prudence. Why wouldn't it be prudent to make an investment in Oregon?
Well, I don't think that's what I said, Senator George.
I do pick up my words here and kind of draw them to some extreme.
It's certainly not what I meant to say, if it is indeed what I said. I think what I was getting at was that there is no partnership that I know of, no general partner that has its mandate is solely to invest in Oregon. So as a practical matter, I don't think you can go out and hire one or two managers or hire a manager that's Oregon only. So, because we can't invest in companies directly, a la the discussion about Senate Bill 22, we are forced to work through fund partnerships and investment managers. In the private equity arena, venture capital arena particularly, that's through general partnership funds where we're an LP. So by definition, you have to put money with general partners, and the way you narrow that focus is their strategy is to look at industries where Oregon has an advantage, and for to look at a regional focus. But you can't get it narrowed so much to have an Oregon only focus.
Senator Darcy,
just to follow up. All right, but we're holding the proxy, and we indicated that we might in fact make a decision to influence the investment or just business decisions of a company that we had investment stock in. Why wouldn't we be able to put more pressure to direct those dollars back to Oregon?
Well, again, private equity is not public stock, so you don't have the proxy rights, so you don't have the proxy voting rights.
But we don't have any influence over that. We can't tell them we expect those dollars to. We expect you to really concentrate on Oregon to find the investments.
I think that's what we're doing, sir.
Okay, we'll wait and see. Thanks.
Thank you. Really appreciate your time this morning. Committee, for the rest of the week, it is really one topic, and that is the collections and compliance process that we have. We'll have the Department of Revenue up tomorrow, and I believe we have a couple other invited testimony, and then we'll go to a public hearing on Wednesday and look at marking up a bill on Thursday based on what we hear Tuesday and Wednesday. And again, we'll move to 8:30, our usual start time, starting next Monday, and go at 9 for this week. Thank you. We are adjourned.